This is Fresh Air, and my name's Terry Gross. My guest is playwright Edward Albee. His best-known play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, opened on Broadway in 1962. Although the play won many awards, it offended some audiences and critics. A calculated exercise in depraved obscenity is what critic John Chapman called it. In 1966, the play was adapted into a film of the same name, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton as the neurotic, bickering couple. Edward Albee's other plays include The Zoo Story, The Death of Bessie Smith, The Sandbox, and The American Dream. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes, For a Delicate Balance in 1967 and Seascape in 1975. Edward Albee was brought up in a theater family. His grandfather co-founded the Keith Albee Theater Chain. There were frequently performers visiting the Albee house when Edward Albee was growing up.
As I recall, they were mostly vaudeville people. Most of them now long dead, but I remember people like Ed Wynn coming to the house, and Billy Gaxton and people like that that nobody under 106 remembers anymore.
Do you think that helped interest you in the theater?
I don't know. Since I didn't write my first play till I was 29, it would suggest that I was pretty slow to learn if it did interest me.
Did you plan on being a writer when you were back in school?
Oh, yeah. I started writing when I was 6. I started writing poetry.
You went to Valley Forge Military Academy for about a year, which is in this area. Did you ever plan on a military career?
I got put into Valley Forge Military Academy because I kept getting thrown out of other prep schools. And there was a law on the books, I guess, then that said that your parents couldn't put you in a reform school, no matter how badly you thought you were behaving. So they put me in the next best thing, I guess.
What did you do that was so ill-behaved?
I went to those classes that I liked, didn't go to the ones that I didn't like. I didn't pay any attention to professors that I thought weren't very interesting. And the way a person should be educated, and if the world were ideal.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that people always tell you. When you grow up, you'll realize all that you missed, and you'll be sorry that you missed out on those classes and that you misbehaved. Did you ever have any regrets?
No, none whatever. And I didn't have too much educational experience at Valley Forge Military Academy, as I recall it. Courses in sadism and masochism and things like that.
You also were asked to leave, or it was suggested you didn't come back to Trinity College after a year and a half. Did you feel that your future was ruined after that?
No, I have just always found, both in school and out of school, that extracurricular activities are much more useful, valuable, and fun than anything that is prepared for you.
Why did you decide to write a play at the age of 29?
Because I was a writer, and I was a lousy poet and a terrible novelist and not very good at the essay or the short story. And what else was there?
That play was The Zoo Story. Mm-hmm. Could you describe that in capsule form for our listeners who haven't seen or read it?
Well, yeah. It is an hour-long confrontation in New York City Central Park between a man named Peter who is, well, adjusted to his society, a middle-brow, middle-class, young middle-aged man, nicely married with kids, reading a book in Central Park when he is accosted by a man named Jerry, who has been variously described by critics, depending upon their bents, as A, a psychopath, or B, Jesus Christ. No critic ever getting it right that he was sort of both. And Jerry tries to impose upon Peter a sense of what it is like to be alive. To teach him, in other words, so that there's a great deal more to living than what most people seem to understand. And Peter keeps refusing to understand what's going on. And as a result, Jerry has to teach by the final example of getting himself killed.
That play was rejected by New York producers.
Well, mind you, understand, back in 1958, 59, there really was no off-Broadway. And Broadway producers weren't interested in producing an hour-long one-act play by a completely unknown American writer. They still aren't, you know, but then it was even less true.
The first production was in Berlin.
The first production was in West Berlin in German.
Oh, I didn't
realize
that.
On a double bill with Beckett's Krapp's Last Tape. Yes, I saw my first play under the title Die Zoogeschichte.
Did you feel that your play had an affinity with Krapp's Last Tape?
You know, I hadn't read Krapp's Last Tape or seen it when they were done together, but I got a hold of the script, and I was delighted by the pairing, and you know, a man that I admired so much. It was such a good play as Krapp's Last Tape.
Did you get to meet Beckett then?
Oh, yes, I got to know him. Not right then, but we got to know each other afterwards. What a nice man.
Would you talk much about playwriting when you were together?
No. Playwrights don't talk about playwriting when they get together. They talk about what everybody else talks about, sex and money and food and attacking critics and things like that.
Would you ever say to Beckett, what do you really mean in that play?
No, certainly not. I'm supposed to know. and if it isn't clear in the play to anybody who's reasonably informed about the nature of the theater, then all the explanation in the world isn't going to do any good. You know, if I like something that somebody does, I'll tell them. I'm not going to hide my enthusiasm from them. But no, playwrights don't sit around together talking about how to write plays.
When it was produced in New York, The Zoo Story, what kind of reaction did it get from audiences and critics?
Every single play of mine, it's misunderstood by a lot of people who seem to think that some of them got all rave reviews. They never did. No play of mine has ever gotten any better than mixed reviews. With Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Mr. Chapman with its calculated depravity, and Walter Kerr saying it had a hole in its head. And Zoo Story got some good reviews and some pretty bad ones. But that's been all the way down the line for me. Very interesting.
Let's talk about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is, I think, probably your most famous play.
Well, certainly it's the one that was made into the best-selling movie, and so it probably is better known than any of the others, sure.
I had read somewhere that you got the title from some graffiti that you'd seen once. Is that true?
Well, if you're a writer, you go around places and you accumulate information and things, and you watch and you listen. I remember once I was in a saloon on 10th Street, Greenwich Village, which is no longer the same saloon. It's changed management and changed its nature since then. But it was on 10th Street between Greenwich Street and Waverly Place. And there was a downstairs bar, as I remember. And people wrote things in chalk on the bar walls and wrote things in soap on the back of the mirror of the bar, the mirror behind the bar. And one night I was in there and I saw a sign behind the bar in soap that said, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Now, this was 10 years before I started writing plays, but it stuck in my head.
Why did it stick? What?
Just good fortune, I guess.
Why?
I like puns, I suppose.
Why did that work as the title for the play?
Well, I originally called the play The Exorcism or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And then I got wise to myself, decided that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was a far better character. And I justified it just by saying that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf means who's afraid of the big bad wolf, and the big bad wolf being living life without false illusions. So I justified it that way.
Can I ask you again for a capsule?
Wow, that's difficult.
I know.
It concerns a faculty couple, George and Martha, and their late-night visitors after a faculty party, another couple, Nick and Honey. While a great deal goes on in the course of the play, a great deal of yelling and screaming and carrying on, the play concerns itself basically with the exorcism of a non-existent child that Martha and George have created to do battle with themselves with. And the play concerns the exorcism of that child on the eve of its 21st birthday, after which it could no longer be exorcised since it would be an adult.
There is a lot of neurotic arguing within that relationship of
I think it's pretty healthy. You know, you used the term neurotic before, which was a quote from somebody. I don't think they're neurotic people at all. Neurotic people strike me as people who cannot vent their spleen. And these people get it off their chest quite nicely. And my goodness, they've had a relationship of 22, 23 years, and they do love each other very much. It's just that there's an awful lot of extraneous baggage that's got to be gotten rid of. So I've never found them particularly neurotic.
But they don't really get it off their chest in that no matter how much they vent it, it still remains on their chest and there's
I think by the end of the play, they've come to a considerable understanding of each other. So it's far more optimistic than pessimistic play.
Did you see at that time a lot of relationships around you that reminded you of the one you created?
I would start going to universities and do readings or lectures in the first 4 or 5 years after the play came out. Every university I went to, Some member of the faculty would take me aside and say, oh, you've been here before, haven't you? Because obviously you know Professor so-and-so and his wife, after whom you modeled. And of course, since I'd spent no time at Trinity College when I was there and didn't know anything about faculty people, obviously it was another case of life imitating art.
Are you interested in psychoanalytic theory?
No more than I am in anything else.
Have you read up on that?
Oh, sure. I read a lot.
Do you think that American playwrights are more interested in psychological issues than playwrights from other countries are? Because I'm thinking of your work, Tennessee Williams.
Well, no, I don't think my work is so varied.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from absolutely, well, Brechtian naturalism in The Death of Bessie Smith to highly stylized satire in The Manner of Ionesco in The American Dream to the most opaque experimentation in some of the other plays. So I don't fit into any of those categories because I'm always moving about the spectrum. But generally speaking, I think American theater is far more influenced by Ibsen and Chekhov than it is by Brecht, by Pirandello, by people of that sort. American education does not give most people the particular glibness of mind and glibness of tongue that some of our European playwrights have. And so our plays don't tend to be quite so obviously intellectually concerned. I'm thinking of people like Stoppard and people of this sort now. I suppose and also American audiences don't tend to like experimental theater anywhere near as much as they like straightforward theater. And since there are an awful lot of playwrights who are cottoning to what an audience wants rather than what an audience should want, sure, you get a lot of that. But I would imagine that if you examine most of the plays that are written almost anywhere, most of them are fairly Ibsenesque and Chekhovian and post-naturalistic. Experimentation is always the outside chance.
The faculty people who you met who always said, well, surely you must have met blah, 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 because they're just like the couple you created. There are so many couples that never do arrive at that understanding that your couple comes to at the end of the play, who live together on and on, having this incredibly argumentative, bickering relationship. Do you have any idea what keeps people like that together? I figure it's something you must have thought about.
Well, I suppose a certain sadomasochism must, unless it's a Catholic marriage, but even those are beginning to break down now. I don't really know the answer to it. Some people must obviously enjoy it to a certain extent. One faculty couple at a very prestigious ladies' college on the Hudson River near Poughkeepsie did a performance for me one night where they actually did a knockdown and drag out fight at a party after a reading of mine. I was quite astonished by it. One would have thought they'd rehearsed it. I mean, they did, obviously, in their own lives.
Someone was telling me that in their college drama English class that their teacher had told them to think of the play as George and Martha as being a gay couple having that relationship. Have you heard people talk about
that? Yes, I have. That came about very curiously because there was a man who used to be a movie critic for Newsweek magazine. I forget his name. Doesn't matter. He's gone. Who, when the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf came out, said that as much as he admired the play, he could not bring himself to accept it as an accurate representation of a heterosexual couple, and therefore it could not be. Well, which tells you something about the way the critical mind works from time to time. No, I wrote it, obviously, about two heterosexual couples. If I'd wanted to write it about a couple of gay couples, I would have done it. But it wouldn't work. You know, what do you do about the non-existent child? What do you do about the hysterical pregnancies? What do you do about a whole number of things? It's silly nonsense.
What did you think of the film adaptation with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton?
Well, since I had been promised Betty Davis and James Mason, I wasn't too happy.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, why would I say it?
I don't know.
Let's see. I'd been promised Pluto and Donald Duck. That's not true. What is true is I'd been promised Betty Davis and James Mason. And so that would have been nice.
So you were disappointed?
Sure. Elizabeth Taylor was, at least 20 years too young for the role. And I didn't think it was as good a movie as it could have been. It was odd that Mike Nichols, who directed it, who'd made his career as a stand-up comic, managed to take a very funny play and make a humorless movie out of it. I guess this was to prove that he was a serious director, or to prove that he was a humorless director anyway.
You think serious people who have a reputation for humor, who want to prove that they're serious, just
become humorless.
Become humorless, right. Burton and Taylor were married at the time. Do you think that helped or affected their performance in any way?
It brought a lot of people into the theater. I spent at the movie house, I suppose. That's all right. And I noticed that Burton was very nicely supportive of Elizabeth and made her look very, very good in the course of the film. I just thought the balances were off a little bit. The film had a delicate balance, which practically nobody has ever seen since it was made by the American Film Theater, apparently so nobody would ever see the films they made. That was a much better film with Paul Scofield and Katharine Hepburn. That was a first-rate film, very accurate representation of what I had in mind.
Do you like to work in any way with the director or the screenwriter when one of your works is adapted?
Well, there's never been a screenwriter on either of the two plays of mine that have been made into films. I am credited with a screenplay of A Delicate Balance, but all I did was cut a little bit. Ernest Lehman, the producer, is credited with the screenplay of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, though there was no screenplay. There was merely a rearrangement of my words. Apparently there was a fairly elaborate screenplay which departed considerably from what I had done, but that was never used.
Were you consulted?
Of course not.
Would you have liked to have been?
Yes, certainly. Sure.
The movie Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf introduced your work, though it wasn't exactly your work and you weren't that happy to it, but it introduced your play to millions of people
who don't go to
the theater.
Of course. Yeah. That's nice. You know, I would imagine that considering the fact that the movie did play to a lot of people, and it is shown on television somewhere at 4 o'clock in the morning usually, just somewhere all the time, I imagine more people have seen the film of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf than have ever seen performances of any of or all of my plays together or will for the next 100 years. But that tells us more, that tells us less about absolute value than it does about how one medium reaches larger audiences than others.
Since you're not that happy with the movie, does it bother you that people who've only seen that film wouldn't truly understand your work?
They would have a fair appreciation of that particular play, but since that particular play is only one aspect of what I've been up to for the past 24, 25 years, they would get a fairly limited understanding, but better that than nothing, huh?
Do happy relationships interest you for plays?
Personally, yes.
No, for plays, though, as a writer.
Plays, good plays are not made up of people getting along particularly well. There has to be conflict, people in conflict either with each other, themselves, their society, whatever. And plays are not made along. Well, Oedipus Rex is the exception there, isn't it? People getting along too well, perhaps. But generally speaking, that's not the nature of serious drama.
Do you find that people assume that you must know a lot of unhappy relationships
They seem to assume it, yes. I'm merely fairly observant, and I can make things up as well as the next man.
You've done several adaptations.
Four, I think, yes.
The most recent one was Lolita.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
It came about because somebody asked me if I'd like to do it, and I jumped at the chance. The production was appalling. It was a disgrace, and it should never have opened, and it closed very, very quickly. The play is very good. The production was a disgrace, and I'm sorry that anybody saw it.
When you see a production not taking shape in the way that you should, will you, as the writer, go in and argue for what you believe should be done
with
the
director?
I will,
yes. What happened with Lolita is that I must preface this by saying the play had as in its starring role of Humbert, a movie actor who fancies himself a stage actor as well, by the name of Donald Sutherland. And I have been informed by Donald Sutherland's lawyer that I am not to make any comments about his shenanigans during the rehearsal or performance of Lolita for fear of lawsuit, so I may not talk about how appalling I thought his behavior was. I may not talk about his rewriting of lines, about his refusal to perform the play as I wrote it. I can't talk about his refusal to play the character as complex as it was. I can't discuss any of that. What a pity. It'd be nice if I could discuss it, but I don't want to be sued. I have never worked with an actor that I found it more unpleasant to work with. The director, I found sycophantic to Mr. Sutherland's demands to a point where not only did I have the star against me, but I had the director against me. And the producer who had stolen, I believe, I'm told, the play away from another producer in what, a wrestling match or something, I have no idea, decided to produce it on the cheap and as soft porn. And so it was three strikes against me. I could have fought one of them. I could have fought the star. I could have fought the producer or the director. But you get all three lined up against you. There's absolutely nothing you can do. And so I watched it going down the drain. And I just knew that when the reviews came out, I knew who was going to get the blame for everything. Me.
Well, what do you do then? Because it sounds defensive if you try to disassociate yourself.
Well, you can't, you know. You just keep fighting to the last minute and hope that some miracle will happen. You just shrug and go about your business and assume that someday there will be a decent production of it and people will realize that they made the wrong value judgment.
Mm-hmm. Edward Albee is my guest. You won two Pulitzer Prizes in 67 and 75 for A Delicate Balance and Seascape.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the Pulitzer committee, are those the two plays you would have chosen to give your Pulitzer?
Oh, no, I've had many more plays on Broadway than that. That doesn't sound very nice to say, does it? Those are pretty good plays. I don't mind those at all. I would have given it to a couple of others.
Which ones?
Oh, let's see. Well, I don't want to do that because that makes it sound as if I think that whenever I have a play on Broadway, it's better than anybody else's play on Broadway. And whether I think that or not, it's not a matter. The Pulitzer Prizes, like all prizes, they're around. It's nice to win them if they're around. And it's fun to be surprised when you do and fun to be surprised when you don't.
I think you've said that in each of your plays, you're experimenting with something other, with language or with the structure of
mm-hmm.
it. Can you describe some of the recent experiments you've undertaken in your recent plays?
It's awfully hard to talk about the kind of experimentation I do because it is so subtle. Some of my plays are highly allied to musical structure. One of them is in passacaglia form, for example. I'm as much concerned with the sound of language as Beckett is, for example, or Chekhov was. I'm always making experiments in the musical relationships between drama and music. I'm interested in making the theatrical experience whenever I can, something slightly different than it's ever been before, to make people broaden their expectations of what theater can do. But it's awfully hard to talk specifically about it. You know, it's no fun just to write a story. It's fun to try to change the world a little bit when you do something.
Do you consider any of your work autobiographical?
I've never written specific autobiography. I find that my life tends to be quieter and less interesting than that of my characters. But at the same time, I've never written a character that hasn't been filtered through my own perception. So how do you answer that question?
I suppose like you just did. do you ever get to work closely with the actors? You were talking before about
certainly, quite often.
Do actors ever ask you for your interpretation of a character?
Well, quite often I direct my plays, you see. I'm one of these playwrights who directs. I directed the revival of Virginia Woolf on Broadway in 76. I directed Seascape on Broadway, which got the Pulitzer. I've directed a number of my plays on Broadway and off and around the country. Whenever I'm working with an actor and the actor has a problem and I'm director, I will talk directly with the actor about the problem. If somebody else is directing, I will try to talk through the director rather than undermine the director's authority.
You were saying
that's just courtesy.
You were saying before that playwrights don't talk to each other about plays or about what something really means.
Well, we talk
means.
About other people's plays, but we don't talk about the art and craft of playwriting very much.
If an actress comes to you and says, I don't really understand, is this supposed to symbolize something? What's at the bottom of this? Will you talk in those terms about it? Has that ever happened?
I have never had an actor ever ask me about symbolism in a play.
Really?
Actors are really so concerned with the three-dimensional truth of whatever they're doing that there's no time for that.
And that pleases you?
Oh, very much, yes.
Does it displease you when someone at a university asks you about the symbolism in a play?
Well, you sort of expect that more at a university than you do in real life.
Will you give line readings to the actors?
I find that I write lines so specifically that line readings determine themselves quite often. I use a lot of punctuation and underlining and stress and indications of how lines are supposed to be read. I'm pretty precise, more precise than most playwrights about how lines are supposed to be spoken. And while I don't want to force any actor to read a line the way I wrote it, I notice that most of them come around to it by just naturally.
Your plays are taught in, I think, most theater departments, drama departments, in universities around the country. Do you keep up with how your plays are taught? Do you have any opinions of what you've seen or heard about?
Oh, every once in a while I'll go to university and I will be told that somebody has said thus and so, which is a crock, and I try to correct the impression. I'm of two minds about being taught. I guess it's good to be taught, but I suppose it must make people resent you a little bit that they have to study you sometimes.
Oh, because you're the required reading, yeah, as opposed to the extracurricular.
Yeah,
stuff.
I don't know whether one wants to be required reading or not.
Do you ever read plays, and do you feel that you can really judge a play from reading?
Oh, yes, goodness, a play is literature. Whenever I judge a number of, or am a judge on a number of play contests every year, and I'm very specific. I don't want to judge the contest unless I have either seen and read all of the plays, or merely read all of the plays. I would not judge any play merely having seen it.
Really?
No.
Because it might be a bad production.
That's right. Or a distorting production, a worse production. I think I can usually see the play through the production. But a play is literature, and it exists on the page. A good play is not proved on the stage, is not rather improved on the stage. It's proved. And I rather read them, because I can see a production of a play in my head and in my ear when I read it. I know exactly the way the play truly is on stage.
Do you think that Broadway or off-Broadway has changed much since 1959?
Broadway has become hopeless. It is the home of trash and the middle brow. It's not a respectable place for anybody seriously minded to work in the theater. The economics are just too crippling. And apparently people don't want to be told as much truth about themselves at $45 a ticket, and they used to want to be told at $8 a ticket. And you don't find very many very good plays on Broadway. You find infinitely more in the smaller theaters.
Do you think that Broadway, off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway have expanded since you started?
Oh, off-off-Broadway, goodness, yeah. Yes. That's where the great majority of the serious work is done.
Do you go to theater a lot?
Oh, sure. Far more than I want to.
Then why do you go?
Because I'm probably the most enthusiastic member of any theater audience. I go there expecting enlightenment and a miracle. And every once in a while it happens, and it's wonderful when it does.
Playwright Edward Albee.